Since the last lecture, I saw on the blackboard lots of things with continued fractions. Again, let me start this lecture with something that has nothing to do with anything I'm going to say, but you might find this amusing. Is that, does everybody know what this is? 1 over 1 plus 1 over 1 plus 1 over 1 plus... Anybody ever see this continued fraction before? Golden ratio. Okay, it's the golden ratio. But why is the golden ratio?
Because that's kind of a fixed point of taking ratio.
Okay, very good, very good. And one other thing about the golden ratio, which you may or may not know, is that the golden ratio is considered the most irrational number. Does people ever hear that terminology? That the thing is that you have the real line, and interspersed in the real line are the rational numbers, which are, countably infinite set, which are everywhere dense. And that means that any irrational number has the closest approximate with a rational number. But the golden ratio is the furthest away from any rational number. So it's really kind of bizarre. And in fact, it comes from the properties of the bizarre continued fraction. So continued fractions are really cool because you can think of them as a dynamical system, because you can look at these remainders and ask, how do these remainders evolve as you go down the sequence? And you can think of that as a dynamical system, and there's all kinds of amazing properties. Anyways, all right, so some of you know it, and those of you who don't know it, prove it, that that's the golden ratio. It's kind of fun. Okay, so today's lecture, I definitely will finish talking about spin systems, and then I'm going to turn to the kinetics of chemical reactions, and I'm going to discuss two subtopics in this area. One is I'm going to talk about reactions in the mean field limit, and then I'm going to talk about reactions in the mean field limit, but taking into account discreteness effects. And both of these subjects are extremely rich, and I'm only going to give you a little taste of it, but I hope that you'll find that this taste is very tasty. So let me just, first of all, talk about coarsening in one dimension. And at t equals 0 plus. And what do I mean by t equals 0 plus? Well, I mean the temperature is infinitesimal. It's so tiny that, as you'll see, there's a reason why I have to force the temperature to be 0 plus for Kawasaki dynamics. So what we've seen is for the Ising-Glauber model, so IG means Ising-Glauber, domain walls are the fundamental excitation. So the lowest, low-lying excited state of the system, if you start with a ferromagnetic ground state, the first excited state is a single domain wall, next excited state is two domain walls, and so on. And at very low temperatures, you will then form a dilute gas of these domain walls. And so let's just focus attention on the domain walls. So I have, say, a domain wall particle here, here, here. And in between, I have a domain of spin up. Here I have a domain of spin down, and then spin up, et cetera, down the road. And so I have these domain wall particles. And what we learned at zero temperature, so for the Ising model, I can actually consider T exactly equal to zero mathematically. There's no problem with this limit, which you'll see where it arises in just a moment. So in the case of zero temperature, what are the possible states of evolution of the system? What we found is that the state where three upspins could flip to this occurred with rate zero. This event, where a single domain wall, so I have two oppositely oriented spins, and then the central spin flips, making the domain wall hop to the left, this happens with rate 1/2. And this possibility, where I have two domain walls nearest neighbor and the spin flips, this happens with rate 1. So in the low temperature, in the limit of zero temperature, and if we wait for a very long time, we see that domain walls can either diffuse or annihilate. So in the long time limit, there won't be very many domains because they're always annihilating. And so we have a dilute gas of the domains. And then if I look as a function of time, these domains are just doing some kind of diffusive motion. Whenever two domains meet, they're basically going to annihilate. And the question is, what is the size of these domains as a function of time? And I gave kind of a weak argument last time. Let me give a slightly better argument today. And so what I'd like to argue is that let me write down an equation for the evolution of the domain sizes. And what I'd like to say is that when two domains, when a domain disappears, these two domains have joined. And if there's a characteristic, single characteristic domain size, so under the assumption of scaling, then this domain and this domain are same order of magnitude. So when this central domain disappears, the domain, roughly speaking, doubles in size. So roughly speaking, the change in the domain length is of the order of L. How long do I have to wait for this to occur? Delta T. In order for a domain of size L, for this guy to disappear, the two particles have to diffuse of the order of the spacing between the domains, between the domain wall particles. And this time is of the order of L squared divided by D. So this turns into a rate equation that tells me how L changes with time. And you see that L dot is equal, if I just solve over here, I'm going to get D over L, or L dot is equal to D, whose solution is L is equal to the square root of dt. So this gives me the classic t to the 1/2 coarsening that characterizes non-conserved order parameter dynamics. So while this derivation came for the specific case of the Ising-Glauber dynamics, any type of dynamics which involves local spin flipping and does not conserve the order parameter has this type of dynamics. Now let me turn to Kawasaki dynamics. And now it's a little bit trickier because single domain walls are not really the fundamental excitation in the system, because you need a pair of misaligned spins. You need a pair of misaligned spins to actually exist in order to have any kind of excitation. So for example, in Kawasaki dynamics, if I look at a single domain wall, so I have here two misaligned spins. And now let's imagine that we're looking at very low temperature. If these spins were to flip, so I do this up, and now this turns down, up, down. What's happened now is that I've created three domain walls. So single isolated domain walls are very stable if I now consider the limit temperature almost but not quite zero. This event will occur with a very small probability. What is the probability that this event occurs? Well, from this detailed balance condition, the probability of going up in energy is just related to the ratio of the energy difference between this state and this state. In this state, I have one unhappy bond, which has an energy plus 2j over the ground state. Here I have three unhappy bonds, which has an energy plus 6j over the ground state. So here's an energy cost of 4j. So delta E is equal to 4j. And that means that the probability, or the transition rate, of making this event will be proportional to E to the minus 4 beta j. So a very tiny probability in the limit of temperature going to zero or beta going to infinity. Or conversely, I can say that there's a characteristic time. How long do I have to wait for this event to occur? If this happens with probability 10 to the minus 10, then I should wait 10 to the 10 seconds, or 10 to the 10th time units, to ever see this once. So the characteristic time scale, which is proportional to e to the 4 beta j. So first point is that isolated domain walls are not the elementary excitations in the system, because they don't diffuse freely. They're not the natural characteristic of the problem. And another important feature here is this is why I'm going to need temperature equals 0 plus. Because if the temperature were truly zero, and I start with some random initial condition, what can happen? So let's look at the other types of scenarios in the system, which is I could have had, for example, now I have a single domain wall. There's this situation where I have two domain walls. And if I now pick one of the side spins and let it flip, you see that the environment is both spins, up, down, up, up. OK. So in this particular case, if I flip this pair of spins, or exchange the spins, then the system goes to up, 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 down, up. And what's happened is that this pair of domain walls has diffused freely, zero energy cost. So in some sense, that's the analog of this situation here. So there's a correspondence between domain wall diffusion here, and here you have pairs of domain walls diffusing. Notice, though, if I look at the level of a single spin, if I just focus on the spin, all that's happened is that this down spin has just moved one step to the right. So single isolated spins can actually freely diffuse, and they're kind of the elementary excitation in this system. So the elementary excitation are isolated spins. And what I mean by isolated spins is one down spin in a sea of up, or vice versa. They're the things that can diffuse freely with no energy cost. Now, the other thing is that in addition to having energy-raising events, energy-neutral events, there's also energy-lowering events. We can have a situation where this state goes that away, and then that's an energy-lowering event. And so these three possibilities, energy-neutral, energy-raising, and energy-lowering, are the analogs of these states. And in a limit of temperature getting going very small, the energy-neutral events can occur with rate 1/2. The energy-raising events occur with a rate 0. But now we don't have 0 as our temperature. We have 0 plus. So this rate, you know, I can think of this as 0 plus. 0 plus. Whereas energy lowering events will occur with the rate 1. And what I want to now do is show you in a very simple argument how this gives rise to T to the 1/3 coarsening. And again, this is a very general result, and I'm showing it to you in a very specific example, but it turns out to be far more general than just this specific example. So let's imagine the same kind of situation as here. Let's imagine that we look in the very long time limit as the system is coarsening, but it's coarsening with order parameter conserving dynamics, Kawasaki dynamics. So let's imagine that we start with a situation that looks the same as over here. We're going to have the domain of spin up. There's a domain wall, which is no longer an elementary excitation. Spin down, then spin up, and another domain wall, et cetera, down the road. So the thing is that according to Kawasaki dynamics, this system is, if it was zero temperature, would be stuck forever. This is part of the reason why Kawasaki dynamics is much different in character, because at zero temperature, it goes to a metastable state, because this is not the ground state, but it's a metastable state with infinitely high barriers, because you have to raise the energy to get out of the state, and that's why you have to force the temperature to be slightly bigger than zero. So now let's imagine that, so the point here is that I have to wait, you know, a really long time for an energy raising event to occur, but on that time scale, energy lowering and energy neutral events occur infinitely quickly. So here is a natural picture of how to describe this dynamics, which relies on the separation of time scale between energy raising events and energy lowering events. Let's imagine that this characteristic time is now our unit of time. We'll measure time in units of this e to the 4 beta j. So if the time is 10 to the 10th, we're going to say, well, our clock will advance by one unit every e to the 4 beta j. And then on that clock scale, all other events occur essentially instantaneously, because they're occurring on a time scale of 1 over this time, which is really short. So now let's imagine that we look at a time here, this delta t. You know, this will be a time tau, which is of the order of e to the 4 beta j. So on this time scale, every place that there is a domain wall like this, there is an energy raising event. And so let's just draw what the energy raising event is. So I continue with my domain of plus. These two spins flip, and so I'm going to get down, up, down, 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 and then and what's happened now is that I've created three domain walls. Now, at this stage of the game, and also let me now not draw anything further, because it's just going to be, it's a little bit gloppy to draw it. But now, at this stage of the game, two things can happen. We can either lower the energy, by having these two spins flip back again, in which case we come to the initial state, or with some non-zero chance, we'll have an energy neutral event. And as we saw from over here, whenever I have an isolated spin, which corresponds to two domain walls which are nearest neighbor, these two domain walls can freely diffuse. So this pair could start hopping to the right and freely diffuse with no energy cost. So let's look at the next step. Suppose that these two spins, these two domain walls diffused over here. So what that does it correspond to in terms of the spin picture? So we had our initial domain wall, which is left behind. If these two guys hop to the right, what that means is I have downspin, downspin, downspin over here. This is now up. This is down. This is down. This is up. So what you see is that this domain, which extends off as far as it did, we had our initial domain, which extended like this, our second domain, which did something like this. Now we have our domain, and you see that inside of the down domain is this little intruder. This intruder can now diffuse freely. And once he diffuses freely, it has two possible outcomes. This intruder can come back to here, and then this triple can then go to a singlet, and then I've done nothing. Or this intruder can go all the way to the other side. So if this intruder diffuses over here, at the end of this process, if it did this, then what you would see is that I had, here was my domain like this, here was my domain like this. So suppose the intruder got all the way to this side, and then it got incorporated to this domain. At the end of this process, what you would have is the domain here would have done this. Let me maybe, so here is my path of my domain. And at the end of this, I would have my domain, which was one shorter. Notice it's one shorter. This domain has moved over here. So now let me draw the next domain. Here was a domain. Here was a domain. And at the end of this process, this last guy is moved over here. So what we see is at the end of this process, this central domain has just rigidly moved one step to the left, and one domain has increased in size by one, and another domain has decreased in size by one. So that is the basic physics of what goes on in this very, very low temperature dynamics. And using that fact, we're now in a position to estimate how the domain size grows with time. Yes?
Why doesn't he just align with the central unit? Why doesn't he flip to a downspin?
Here.
Yep.
Because it's spin exchange dynamics. You can't just single spin flip this and lower the energy because that does not conserve the magnetization. This is magnetization conserving only.
Yes.
So the natural thing you might think doesn't work here. OK. So the point is that in order for, so if I call this domain, let's call this L minus L and L plus. At the end of the process, we have L minus minus 1. We have L and L plus. Plus 1 are the lengths of the domains. And now the thing is that in a time scale of tau is e to the 4 beta j, roughly speaking, at every single interface, this nucleation event has occurred. And now we can use that fact to estimate the time rate of change of the domain length. So let's calculate the change in the domain length. Boy, this is wimpy chalk. The change in the domain length as a function of the time that it takes for the domains to actually evolve. So again, the same kind of thing happens as over here, that if I wait a time where two domains meet, or two domain wall particles meet, it kind of happens homogeneously throughout the system. So domains typically will double in size. Similarly here, I want to estimate the change in the domain length at the end of this process. Sorry, I just have to check something. Okay, very good. Sorry about that. Okay, so now I want to do the same kind of argument I did over here. So the point is the following, which is that now we see that we've changed, we can think of a renormalized picture where instead of focusing on individual spins, we focus on the domain motion itself. And so we see that here, we can think of at the end of this process where there was nucleation of an intruder that diffused across a system, that what's actually happened is that a domain has rigidly hopped by one step to the side. So the thing is that now I can say that whenever a domain has diffused rigidly of the order of its entire length, so when one domain has now diffused of its of the order of its entire length, then basically what happens is two domains on the other, on either side of it have coalesced. So again, I'm going to say that in an appropriate time scale that I'm going to estimate, delta L is of the order of L itself. How long do I have to wait for this event to occur? Well, I'd like to say that delta T is of the order of L squared, which is the time that it would take to diffuse of the order of a distance of the domain length, but now divided by the diffusion coefficient, which is not 1, because domains have different diffusion coefficients that I'm going to derive in just a second. So it's the same type of argument, but now let's estimate what is the diffusion coefficient of a domain of length L. And the idea is, again, something that came from lecture 2 of this course, which is that if I now have an intruder, let me draw another picture over here just to illustrate this. So if I have a domain of, say, down spins, and somewhere in the middle of the domain is an intruder. So here's my domain of length L, and here is, whoops, I wanted one upspin in a sea of down. And this single intruder can diffuse freely. And so if he starts at a position, initially the intruder started 1 unit away from the edge of the domain wall. So if he comes back to the origin, nothing happens. But if this thing diffuses all the way across to the other side, then the domain has hopped by a distance of 1. So what that tells me is that I need to solve the first passage problem of what is the probability that's that a random walker that starts 1 unit away from the wall diffuses to the other side. And as we saw in the second lecture, that probability is 1 over L. With the probability 1 minus 1 over L, he comes back to where he started. With the probability 1 over L, he comes all the way to the other side. And that means that this diffusion coefficient is L divided by L squared. And then here we have 1 over L for the diffusion coefficient, because in a single event, with the probability 1 over L, you hop by distance 1, which means that in a time of 1, you hop a distance, you hop a distance 1 in a time of, with the probability 1 over L, you hop a distance 1, and that corresponds to a diffusion coefficient, which is proportional to the inverse length. So the bigger you are, the smaller the chance that you hop. And so if we just gather all the terms here, so this is, what we're going to get then is 1 over L. So we get, I'll get it right yet. That's fine. This is a symptom of my dyslexia, so you're seeing it in action here. So here's L squared, and I guess this is 1 over L up here. Fine, okay. That was tough. Anyway, so this cancels, and so what I get out of all of this is that L squared L dot is equal to 1. And the solution to this is that L scales as t to the power 1/3. So again, notice the contrast between single spin flip dynamics, where we got that L was proportional to t to the 1/2, and here we have L, which is proportional to t to the 1/3. This is a fundamental result that appears generically in all kinds of order parameter conserving dynamics. And so to prove this in general is actually really difficult. And over the past 20 or 30 years, there's been vigorous debates in the literature about what happens in order parameter conserving dynamics. And it took maybe a decade or more of effort to ultimately converge that the right answer was t to the 1/3. And so it's interesting that this debate was extremely vigorous at the time that it was happening. And there was people who claimed it was log t, some people claiming t to the 1/4. But in the end, t to the 1/3 is the answer. So yes, question.
Is this just for one dimensions?
This is true in any, I mean, even though this derivation is for one dimension, this answer is true for arbitrary dimension. This requires a much more sophisticated approach, which typically you do it by a continuum time-dependent Landau-Ginzburg theory. You had a question?
Yes.
OK. If you remember it, ask me again. Yes?
So if we actually calculate a correlation function between two of the walls.
Right. Right. Pardon me?
If we actually went through the calculation,
right.
The domain wall, the domain wall correlation.
Right. Yes, that's right. You would get the characteristic length scale coming out of t to the 1/3. Yes, you remember.
All right, so say I go in the lab and I built my Ising model, and then I can measure the value of z. What is it?
So I like this camera here moving around. Okay, so yeah.
So I mean, I'm in the lab and I built my Ising model, okay. And I don't know if it's conservative or non-conservative or which. You know, is it Glover, is it Kowalski, whatever?
Well,
what's the actual value of z that I measure?
Okay, well, so first of all, I would say that if when you say you build your Ising model in lab, you're going to have to tell me what system you're dealing with. If your Ising model is truly a ferromagnetic spin system, then I would say that generically the type of order dynamics would be order parameter non-conserving, and then you would have t to the 1/2 coarsening. However, if your Ising model that you built was an alloy system where you had conservation of material, then you would be in the framework of the Kawasaki dynamics, then you'd see t to the 1/3 portion.
Would that ever be like in the middle? Like I try and build my ferromagnetic, but I'm not quite there, and I have some number between a half and a third.
No, I mean, it's kind of like there's these different universality classes, and there's just discrete universality classes, and you don't get something in the middle. I mean, that's
why I would actually measure 1/2 or 1/3, or depending on my system.
Yeah, typically that's what you would measure. And so people who've done measurements in the lab with alloy systems or magnetic systems, this is what they come up with. OK, so what I want to turn to now for the rest of this lecture is the kinetics of chemical reactions. And as I understand, you're going to get a course from Sue Coppersmith sometime later on in the semester, or next, I forget when it's going to be, where you're studying, where she's going to give a course in dynamical systems. And what I'm going to do now is I'm going to talk about some very simple chemical reactions that can be described very usefully in the framework of dynamical systems. So I'm going to give you a little baby introduction to dynamical systems in the framework of these chemical reaction processes. And the kinds of chemical reactions I'm discussing are typically in the framework of population biology. So let's now talk about chemical reactions. Or maybe I should call them population biology. Reaction. And all of these processes, they have a very simple interpretation that I think you'll find very appealing. So let's start with the very simplest thing, which is the so-called logistic model. Logistic growth or logistic model. So what is a logistic model? Let's imagine that we have a homogeneous population of people who are inhabiting the planet, and each person can give birth asexually. So that means that you know, we don't worry about it takes two to tango. It's just people just give birth at some rate. But on the other hand, everybody's competing for food. And so when you're competing for food, I look for a piece of food. I see something there. And then you're reaching for a piece of food. And then in order to, someone's got to get it. And someone else is going to die because they starve to death. So it's a very cruel world here. And the thing is that the natural variable that we might compute is how does the density of the system, rho, change with time? And so I would write an equation that that follows this rough description. Well, rho increases because everybody can give birth. So there is a birth rate, k, and there is a density, rho, which means that rho dot would grow exponentially if there was infinite amount of resources and we didn't have to worry about competition. But on the other hand, there is competition. So there is minus r rho squared. So this is the classic logistic model. Now, the thing is that there's some things we can do to simplify things right away. And, you know, as a physicist, you should always do this. If I divide through by k, I can redefine my time as kt, and then I get rid of one constant. And then I can also rescale my densities in units of r, and then I can get rid of both constants. So with no loss of generality, I can write the same equation as rho minus rho squared. You had a question. Who had a question?
So why is the competition of rho squared?
Because I'm just saying that two people are fighting for food. Pardon me? Yeah, because I'm saying that it's a, I mean, there, you want to have some kind of a competition term. Like, for example, without this, you have exponential growth. You want to now include some kind of a damping term that's going to go to, going to make the system go to a finite state. So the simplest description, or the simplest thing in the framework of power series representation is just to put quadratic. And one can explain that by saying that, you know, two people fight over a morsel of food, and only two people meet and fight over it. So it's a bimolecular reaction. I can put any number here bigger than one, and I'll get the same dynamical behavior. And I'll come to that just momentarily. Anyway, so here's the equation. Rho dot is equal to rho minus rho squared. And so if you solve this equation, the solution is rho of t is equal to rho of 0 divided by 1 plus, I guess it's this, rho of 0 equal to t. Oh, I forgot. My memory is shot here. 1 plus rho of 0 e to the t minus 1. That's the exact solution. And I have to admit that I think that if you solve this problem exactly, you gain zero understanding of what's going on. And so I'm going to leave behind the exact solution methods now and present to you a way of analyzing these processes by dynamical systems theory, which then can be applied to systems that you can't solve exactly. You had a question? OK. So the way that one analyze, so first of all, notice what happens here is that as t goes to infinity, rho goes to 1. So t goes to infinity, rho goes to 1. This goes to 1. That's all that happens. So we go to a fixed point density where the balance between birth and competition leads to a steady population. But the right way to analyze this is something known as the phase portrait of the system. And the phase portrait is nothing more than a plot of rho dot as a function of rho. And in terms of this simple phase portrait, you can understand everything right away. You understand all the physics of the problem, and you don't need to do very much mathematics. So let's plot the function rho dot as a function of rho. It's clearly this. It's an upside-down parabola. It starts off linearly for small rho. When rho is equal to 1, it crosses the origin, and then it goes down to minus infinity. The points where rho dot is equal to 0 are known as fixed points. And there are two fixed points. There's a fixed point here, and there's a fixed point here. And notice I gave them different colors because they have different interpretations. And to figure out what's going on, let's now ask what happens out here. At this point where rho is bigger than 1, rho dot is negative. So that means if I have any value of rho which is bigger than 1, I'm going to flow according to this dynamics into this fixed point. On the other hand, if I'm anywhere between 1, 0, and 1, rho dot is positive. So I'm going to be driven to this fixed point. So no matter where I start, as long as I have a non-zero population, I'm driven to the fixed point rho equals 1. That's why I put a dot here, because this is known as the stable fixed point, whereas this guy is the unstable fixed point. It should also be clear that for any dynamical process which has a single maximum and has and goes through zero at zero and any place else will have the same dynamical behavior. The details might be different, but the long-time dynamical behavior will be the same. And in particular, as long as the slope of this curve is non-zero at these fixed points, you will have exponential approach to this fixed point. And the thing is that the way that you analyze this in a little bit more detail is that one studies locally what happens near each fixed point. And clearly, locally near this fixed point, the equation, you know, if I imagine writing, let me go over here. So let's look at the case rho is equal to 1 minus epsilon. And if I plug that into this equation, I'm going to get rho dot is equal to rho minus rho squared. So what that gives me then is minus epsilon dot on the left-hand side of the equation is equal to 1 minus epsilon, which is rho, minus 1 minus epsilon squared. And so I write this as 1 minus epsilon minus 1 minus 2 epsilon, approximately, because I'm going to linearize for small epsilon. And so I'm going to get approximately equal to, so the 1's cancel, and I'm going to get epsilon. So I get epsilon dot is equal to minus epsilon. We all recognize that that's the equation of exponential decay. So the point is that very close to the fixed point, if I have some deviation away from the fixed point, I decay exponentially quickly to the fixed point. So this is the case of a stable fixed point. Whereas at an unstable fixed point, if I choose rho is equal to epsilon, and I'm not going to work this all out, what one finds here is that epsilon dot is equal to plus epsilon, which is the hallmark of an unstable fixed point. So in some sense, all one-dimensional dynamical systems can be viewed as solved, because all you have to do is plot the phase portrait, and your curve of rho dot as a function of rho will have a bunch of fixed points, whatever they are, and you've got to decide who's a stable fixed point, who's an unstable fixed point. And once you've determined that, then you're done. You can just say the long-time behavior is you'll flow to a stable fixed point, and that's the end of the story. So one-dimensional systems are a little bit dull because there's not much to do. So let's now talk about two-dimensional systems. And again, in the framework of population biology, there's one very beautiful example, which you might call two species competition. So in two species competition, you imagine that there's two independent species in the world. Say there's ants and there's frogs, for example. And ants left by themselves evolve by the logistic model. Frogs left by themselves evolve by the logistic model. But the two species somehow, actually, frogs and ants isn't a very good example, because ants don't really kill frogs very well. I don't know. Let's say communists and capitalists, or I don't know what, just some kind of a competitive environment where you have two disjoint populations that, left by themselves, will undergo logistic growth and go to an equilibrium, but the two species compete. So let's call these two species A and B. And let me now write down equations of motion that describe how the densities of A. So now I'm going to use A and B for the densities of the two species. Let's write down simple equations that describe how these densities evolve. So left by themselves, A just does logistic growth. So it's A times 1 minus A. B does B times 1 minus B. But there is a negative effect of when A and B meet, there'll be some reduction in the density. And the simplest way to write this in is to put an epsilon AB. So when a capitalist and a communist meet, they maybe beat each other's brains out, and maybe there's one less of each, and so we lose a little bit of A and B in the interaction. And similarly here, epsilon AB. So this parameter epsilon is going to quantify the degree of the competition. What we want to understand now is what is the evolution of the system as a function of time, and what are the long-time states. So this is an example of a two-dimensional dynamical system. And the thing is that when you're dealing with nonlinear systems of two first-order equations, the type of orbits that can exist in the phase space are much more complex, but in some sense, they're still simple. Simple in the sense that we can analyze more or less everything. Once you leave two-dimensional systems and go to three-dimensional systems with three species, these are fundamentally different in character. One can get all kinds of complex orbits and strange attractors, and this hopefully is something you learn in the course in dynamical systems. So I'm going to stay at the simple level and only talk up to the level of two-dimensional systems or two-component systems. So let's now analyze these equations. And I want to use the same type of approach, this qualitative approach that comes from the phase portrait. And it turns out there's another construct which is extremely useful, which is to study something called the null clines. The null clines are the curves where, for example, A dot equals 0. So the A dot equals 0 null cline is I set A dot equals 0. And what I get then is A times 1 minus A, A times 1 minus A minus epsilon AB is equal to 0. And we can study the behavior on this null cline. And as we're going to see, once we understand what happens at a null cline, we can then patch together local behavior to get the full dynamical behavior in the entire phase plane. Now, yeah, question.
So the null cline then is a fixed point for one population?
Exactly, that's right. Okay. So the intersection of two null clines will actually give you the fixed point itself. Now, the thing is that a little trick that I've always used that helps me along the way is that let's put a greater than or equal to sign, because we're going to use what happens on either side of the null cline. So let me look at the curve where A dot is either is going to be positive. Let's look at the curve A dot equals positive. And the null cline is A dot equals 0. So if I put here greater than 0, I get this. Now, the thing is that we can cancel out the A. So as long as A is not 0, this is OK. And then we have 1 minus A is less than epsilon B. There's similarly a null cline B dot is equal to 0. And if I set B dot equal to 0, then I get from this B, 1 minus B, minus epsilon AB is equal to 0. And again, the correct thing is that this is the null cline, but I find it helpful in terms of just playing around and analyzing to look at the locus where B dot is positive. You'll see why in just a second. So let me just look at this guy. And again, I cancel the common factor, which is now B, and I get the relation 1 minus B is greater than epsilon A. OK, so here are the null clines. Now let's look at what these null clines look like in the phase plane. Now, in the way that I've defined this process, by using the logistic model of this form, in some sense, I'm assuming that my maximum density is going to be 1, because this is kind of the carrying capacity of the system, that it goes to a density overall of 1. So we only really need to look in the unit square. So here is A, here is B, and the unit square is maybe this. So now let's plot these two different null clines. So, and it turns out at this stage something very dramatic happens, and it depends on whether epsilon is less than 1 or epsilon is bigger than 1. So let's consider separately the cases epsilon less than 1 and epsilon greater than 1. And so A and B. So epsilon less than 1 corresponds to weak competition. And you might imagine that if the competition is weak, if I could forget about these terms, I have both species are density 1. And if I have some weak competition, maybe the both species still exist and the density is a little bit less than 1. Let's see if that actually holds. And then we can also ask what happens when the density is when the competition is strong. So here's 1, here's 1, here's 1. OK, so let's look at this null cline. So when A is equal to 1, B is equal to 0. And let me write it this way. B is less than 1 minus A over epsilon. So when A is equal to, OK, so when A was equal to 1, B was equal to 0. And as A decreases, B is going to increase. And when A is equal to, so let me now plot this curve. So when A was equal to 1, B is equal to 0. And when B is equal to, yeah, so when B is equal to 1, when A is equal to 0, B will equal 1 over epsilon. But if epsilon is less than 1, 1 over epsilon is somewhere way up here. So this null cline is a straight line which looks like this. So this is the null cline, A dot equals 0. And now here's why I put the greater than sign here, because what we know is that if B is, so here is a null cline in which on one side of it, A dot is positive, on the other side, A dot is negative. But which way does it go? And that's why I put the positive sign here, because we see that when B is on smaller, I mean, B is below the null cline, so B is smaller, then A dot is positive. So the curve, the flow around the null cline looks that way. So that's one null cline. The other null cline is B dot equals 0, so that's by symmetry, that looks something like that. So this is the null cline B dot equals 0. And in the same way, there is the flow of the vertical coordinate this way. So the intersection of the two null clients means both A dot equals 0, B dot equals 0 is the fixed point. So here is a fixed point. And there's also fixed points here, fixed points here, and fixed points here. I haven't yet drawn like what is the stability of the fixed points. I've just drawn them as dots, but later on they might become open circles if they're unstable fixed points. And now what we can do is patch together the behavior of the null clients to get the global behavior. So you see that the null clients divide the plane into like four different quadrants or four different segments. And let's look at what happens in each of them. So above both null clients, B dot is negative, A dot is negative, so the flow is kind of to the southwest up here. Below both null clients, the flow is up and to the right, to the northeast, and so the flow is that way. In this little wedge, the flow is to the right and up. Right and up. Did I get the right? It's up, up and to the right. So the flow is like that. Sorry, up. Sorry, where am I here? Down? Yes, okay, I'm above this null client, so it's down and to the right. So down to the right is to the southwest. Similarly here, the flow is up and to the left, so the flow is that away. So it's pretty clear that no matter where you start in the phase plane, you're going to be driven to this fixed point. This becomes a stable fixed point. These fixed points are actually unstable. This one is actually, maybe I should draw this with a little X in it, because this point, this fixed point is like completely stable in all directions. So if I perturb in this direction or in that direction, I flow away from this fixed point. For this one, if I have no Bs in the system is drawn to this fixed point. Similarly, if there's no A's in the system, I'm drawn to this fixed point. But if I have a non-zero density of both species, I'm drawn to the central fixed point. So that's behavior of weak competition. For strong competition, when epsilon is bigger than 1, then this A dot equals 0 null client, instead of going above 1, hits below 1. So we do something like that. So here's the A dot equals 0 null client. And again, the flow is like this and like that. And similarly, the other null client, this guy, does something like that. So this is B dot equals 0. And the flow was, again, that away. So once again, we have a fixed point over here. And I'm drawing it as a circle now, because if we now try and patch together the global flow, everything is different in its character. So again, let's look in each of the four segments. So above both null clients, the flow is to the left and down. So the flow is to the southwest, as before. Down here, the flow is to the northeast. But here, something interesting has happened, because the relative sense of the two null clients has been exchanged. So in this region, the flow is up, because it's to the left of this guy, and to the left. So the flow is that away. And here, the flow is like that. So what's happened now is this becomes an unstable fixed point, and these are the stable fixed points of the system. And this is still an unstable fixed point. So, yes, Chris.
Why do you say that's unstable and not, like, metastable? Because it seems that with a flow coming in...
Well, the point is that if you're at this fixed point, if you are exactly at it, then you stay there forever. But if I'm coming infinitesimally, you like to say you're being drawn in here. So, okay, so I guess what I would say here, you raised a good point, which is that there is a separatrix. Because if I flow right along here, I will very slowly be pushed to this fixed point. But if I'm infinitesimally away, then I'll be drawn something like this. So if I look at the flow diagram, I get something that looks like this. And only one infinitesimal, a set of measure zero will be drawn in towards this fixed point. So you're actually correct. This is actually the form of a saddle point, because it's got one stable direction and one unstable direction. So generically, you're drawn away from a saddle point unless you happen to set your initial conditions exactly right. So the point is that in the limit of strong competition, you don't get any, you don't get any coexistence. Either the communists are going to win or the capitalists are going to win, but they're not going to both stay there forever. So this is, I would say, a very simple system that starts to illustrate how you can understand starting to get complex dynamical behavior with essentially no you know, no detailed analysis, just drawing pictures. Let me now talk about the next model, which is the so-called Lotka-Volterra model. How many people have heard of this guy's, these guys' names? Some of you. Very good. So the story of the Lotka-Volterra model was that, I guess it was Volterra, noticed in 1926 that they were doing statistics on the catches of fish in the Adriatic Sea. And he would notice that the populations, the fish catches, would oscillate as a function of time. And in fact, in this country, my own country, the Hudson's Bay Company is one of the oldest companies that is in existence. And they, what Hudson's Bay Company did like 200 years ago is that they would hire trappers, or they'd pay trappers who would kill foxes and sell their pelts for coats. And what was noticed is that the catches of foxes also oscillated with, as a function of time. So how could that possibly be? How could it be that you have like some ecosystem and populations would oscillate as a function of time? And so Volterra came up with this very simple model, called, which is ultimately called the Lotka-Volterra model, for this prey-predator interaction. So here is the simplest version of the Lotka-Volterra model, which is I'm going to assume that there is a prey, which I'll denote by species A, and there's a predator, which I'll denote by species B now. And I want to write down some dynamical equations that tell me how these species evolve with time. So let's imagine preys are rabbits and predator are foxes, because that's what actually exists up, you know, 500 miles north of here, or 1,000 miles north of here. So for the rabbits, what do rabbits do? When they're left by themselves, they make lots of baby rabbits. So I'll write A dot is proportional to A. But when a rabbit meets a fox, the fox eats the rabbit, one less rabbit. So minus AB.
Why AB?
Because I need a rabbit and a fox to meet. And so the probability that they're going to meet is proportional. In a mean field approximation, I'm imagining the system is very well mixed. And so the only variable in the system is the global densities. And the probability that a rabbit and a fox meet are proportional to their density. It is a fact, though, that the system is not well mixed. And one really should put in spatial fluctuation effects, which is a whole course I could give about the effects of spatial fluctuations in these reactions. Yes?
Do we assume competition as four, or?
Well, here I'm assuming just the rabbit eats the fox. But you might have asked, another, maybe you meant to ask, like, why isn't there a minus A squared term?
Yeah,
okay. Okay, so I'm going to come to that. But the thing is that in the spirit of simplicity, to write down the simplest equation, let me forget about self-regulation of rabbits. And you know, if you think about rabbits that are in like Australia where they're just taking over the land, they've not reached a point where they reach a carrying capacity of the environment. So the effect of the A squared term maybe comes with a small coefficient, so it doesn't play a role yet. So for B, so what happens? Well, if foxes don't have any food to eat, they die. So by themselves, they just die. But when they meet a rabbit, they eat and they survive. And so these are the so-called Lotka-Volterra models. Now, in principle, I should have 1, 2, 3, 4 constants out in front. But I can eliminate three of them immediately by saying, first, I rescale my time by something that gets rid of one constant. I can then rescale my densities in terms of two other constants and get rid of three constants. And so the general model has only one constant. And so this model, while it seems very specialized, it's actually not that special in the sense that there's only one free parameter that exists in this model that I'm setting to one. Yes?
But why might not be? Because they live by themselves. So
they what?
Why are you placing minus in front of it?
Because I'm saying that the foxes, if they don't have any rabbits to eat, they don't eat grass and they don't eat each other, they just will die. So they have no source of food except if they have rabbits to eat. I mean, have I answered your question?
Okay, what about the case of A? Before they exist, how have like the rate at which A changes is proportional to A, which means that they live by themselves without even seeing it.
Yeah, so the thing is that rabbits, they eat grass. And so there's infinite amount of grass in the system. So all that happens when rabbits are left by themselves is they procreate, making more rabbits. And so without any foxes around, this would be a trivial model for the evolution of the rabbit population. So have I answered your question? OK. Anyway, so these are the luck of Otero models. And the thing is that, again, if you want to study the dynamics properly, you know, one has to do a little bit of work. But we can now study the null clines, and something very simple emerges from these null clines with very little work. So let's study the null clines. So the A dot equals 0 null cline would be that I'd have A minus AB is equal to 0. And in fact, I'm not going to study the A dot equals 0 null cline. I'm going to look at when A dot is greater than 0. And that tells me that 1 minus B is greater than 0, or B is less than 1. Similarly, for the B dot equals 0 null cline, I get minus B plus AB is equal to 0. And again, it's easier or more useful to my mind to study the locus where B dot is positive, which would say that minus 1 plus A is positive, which gives me that A is bigger than 1. So now let's look in the phase plane, B, A, and see what happens. So the null cline B equals 1 means, so here's a null cline, B dot, this is the null cline A dot is equal to 0. And so if B is less than 1, then A dot is positive. So the flow on either side of the null cline looks like this. And so this at height 1. And similarly here at 1, we have the other null cline, which is B dot is equal to 0. And so when B dot is positive, A is bigger than 1. So when A is bigger than 1, B dot is positive. So the flow looks like that. And now let's patch together what happens in the entire AB plane. So in this quadrant, we have flow which is up and to the left. So the flow is looking like that. In this quadrant, we have flow which is down and to the left, looking like that. In this quadrant, we have flow which is to the right and down. And in this quadrant, we have flow which is to the right and up. And you see, kind of with almost very little work, that you get a sense that there's some orbiting structure going on. And in fact, the intersection of the two null clines gives a fixed point. So here is a fixed point. And I'm drawing it kind of in a weird way, because I'm drawing it like a bullseye, because it's a very different type of fixed point than what we've seen before. There's another fixed point here, which is where there's no rabbits, and then the foxes just starve to death. So down here is a fixed point. And there's another fixed point where there's no foxes, B is 0, and rabbits. So out here at infinity, there's a fixed point. So I should draw a little line over here. But the interesting dynamics happens here, because first of all, you see that it gives you a sense there might be some orbits happening here. And the question is, what is the nature of these orbits? Do they expand? Do they contract? Do they hit some attractor? And the thing is that in this particular instance, there's something very special about the Lotka-Volterra model. There is a conservation law hidden inside of the Lotka-Volterra model, which means that all these orbits are neutrally stable. So if I look at a particular orbit, it's a closed orbit, just like the Kepler problem. You have closed orbits. Question?
This would be a simple question, but when you rescale our units, we rescale A and B separately.
Yes.
So how come our intersection is that A is equal to B for any such unit? Like, if you rescale them separately, wouldn't this fixed point move around depending on?
Well, I mean, look, if I really wanted to be kosher, I'd put like an A11, an A12, an A21 here, and an A22 here. And then the location, the fixed point would be somewhere, not at 1, 1. But
so in general, it's just there's a fixed point somewhere.
There's a fixed point somewhere, but it doesn't change any of the structure here. And all the algebra is much easier if I make all my constants 1. So that's why I just did that. But you could put in the general problem and see what happens. So anyways, here's what happens. So now the thing is, let me just say a little bit more about this fixed point. This is a very special type of fixed point. This is called a neutrally stable center. And at a neutrally stable center, the eigenvalues of the linearized transformation. So you saw that in the one-dimensional logistic model, I looked at the linear transformation and whether the eigenvalue, you know, when I wrote epsilon dot is equal to some constant times epsilon, whether the constant was positive or negative, said whether it had a stable or unstable fixed point. In two dimensions, you can do the same linearized analysis. Now you get a matrix, a linear transformation matrix, and the eigenvalues of that matrix decide what is the nature of the orbits. If the eigenvalues are both positive, you have an unstable fixed point. If they're both negative, you get a stable fixed point. If they're complex, one gets orbits around the center. And if the real part of the complex eigenvalues is positive, you get spiraling out. If the real part is negative, you get spiraling in. And if the real part is zero, then you get stable centers. So in the case of the Lotka-Volterra model, one has something very special where one gets a stable center. And in fact, it turns out that one can see by playing around with this equation that there's a conservation law. There's a conserved quantity. And because there's a conserved quantity, that means that the orbits are closed, just like in classical mechanics. If you look at the Kepler problem, there is conservation of angular momentum, which tells you that the orbits lie in a plane. And there's another conservation law that maybe some of you have heard of before, this conservation of the Runge-Lenz vector, which forces the orbits to actually be perfectly closed. So Lotka-Volterra is very special because this unrealistic feature of no self-regulation of the rabbits and no self-regulation of the foxes makes this conservation law happen. If you put in any more realism in the model, the beauty, the conservation law disappears, but you get a model which is more realistic. But let me just spend a minute just talking about the conservation law. Because it illustrates, like, when you're dealing with these sorts of equations, there's some very simple tricks that allow you to get a lot of information with very little work. So the thing is that let's look at these equations again. And notice that if I divide the first equation by A, I can write an equation for A dot over A, which is the same as log of A dot, and that's equal to 1 minus B. And similarly, B dot over B is equal to log of B dot, and that's equal to minus 1 plus A. If I add these two equations, then what I'm going to get is log A dot, log A, the whole thing dot, plus log B dot. I want to add them, the ones cancel, and I'm going to get is equal to A minus B. But if I now add these equations up, just add these guys up, we see that if I had A dot plus B dot, that's A minus B, and these terms cancel. So this guy is just A plus B dot. So we found our conservation law, that log of AB minus A plus B is conserved. And by the way, in my notes, equation 5.7 in my notes has a sign error, because I have a minus sign here, but it's a plus sign. So if you want to change the minus to a plus, that's good thing to do. Let me now talk briefly about epidemic models. And there's two generic models that are famous. There's a so-called SIS model and SIR model. SIS stands for susceptible, infected, susceptible. So that means the common cold. Everybody's susceptible to the common cold. You get the common cold, you become infected. Eventually, you get better. But then you're susceptible to the next cold. And so you have this constant cycle of infection, recovery, infection, recovery. And let's write down, again, in the same kind of spirit as the simplest equations that describe the evolution of being infected and being susceptible. Yes?
Yeah, does that mean that while you're sick, you're not susceptible?
Well, because you're already sick. You have the virus. So you have two states. You either have the virus or you don't.
Okay. Oh, so there's only one virus?
Yeah, I'm only talking about, like, one virus. Yes.
Okay, so why are you susceptible afterwards once you're...
Because, like, you get the cold. Once you've gotten the cold, haven't you gotten more than one cold in your life?
Yeah, but it has to be different every time.
That is true, but the thing is that the cold is so rapidly mutating virus that you can think of it as just there is the cold virus that you get, and then you get better, and then you get it again.
Okay.
So again, in the framework of simplicity, let's just think about the simple model where you can get, you recover, and then you can become sick again. So we can write down, again, the same sorts of things, the equations of motion for S dot and I dot. So how does susceptible change with time? Well, how, if you're susceptible, then you could get sick. Or if you were sick, you can become susceptible. So for example, if you were already sick, you were infected, let's write here a recovery rate. So there's some rate of recovery that you go from being infected to being susceptible. So you increase the density of susceptibles by this recovery rate. But then there is an infection rate, K. And if I'm susceptible and I meet my friend who is sick, then there's a chance, minus sign. So if I'm susceptible and I meet someone who's sick, then there's some rate at which the infection is transmitted to me, and then I'll decrease the number of susceptible people, but I'll increase the number of sick people. So I'll have similar here, KSI and then minus RI. So these are the equations of the SIS model. Notice, it's sort of obvious, that S plus I dot is equal to 0, which says that the total population is just conserved. Nobody's dying here. It's just that we're either sick or we're not sick. But that's all. That's the story. But the thing is that because S plus I dot is equal to 0, I can write that S plus I is some constant, which I can choose to be 1 without any loss of generality. And so the thing is that this two-dimensional system is actually a one-dimensional system in disguise, because I can now look at the second equation and write I dot is equal to minus RI plus K. And here I have I, but S is 1 minus I. And what I have then is K minus RI minus KI squared. So this model is nothing more than the logistic model in disguise, because we see that for the density of infected people, if the infection rate is larger than the recovery rate, this term is positive, and one will have a non-zero density of infected people. So for K larger than R, there is I is greater than 0. Whereas if K is less than R, then this term is negative. And then if I go back to my one-dimensional logistic phase portrait, if I'm plotting here I dot as a function of I, so it looked like this upside-down curve, this is appropriate for K larger than R. But if K is less than R, then my phase portrait looks like this, K less than R. And then the flow is always to the origin. And so in the limit of weak infection rate, then everybody gets healthy, and then nobody gets reinfected, and the system is done. So that's the SIS model. Another very popular model and very important model is the so-called SIR model for susceptible, infected, recovered. And so you can think of this as something you get only once in your life, like, for example, the measles, which maybe you guys don't get anymore. But when I was a kid, you'd have the measles, and you had it once in your life, and that was the end of the story. Or it could be a deadly infection where you're susceptible, you get sick, and then you're removed from the population because you're dead. So those are two different words that you can use to describe the evolution of the population. So let's now write down the equation to describe the evolution of the populations here. So S dot. So in this case, again, if you are, so we want to write down equations for S, I dot, and R dot. So if I'm susceptible, I may get sick. And so there's a minus KSI. But the thing is that once I'm sick, I never come back to being susceptible. I'm either completely recovered or I'm dead. Let's be nice here. Let's talk about recovered. But once I'm recovered, then I'm never susceptible again. So once I was susceptible and I become sick, I'm never going to be susceptible again. I have lifetime immunity. But similarly here the equation is, so what happens here? So there is some rate at which I'm removed from the population. So now instead of thinking of R as the recovery rate, I'm thinking of R as the removal rate. Once I'm sick, then with some rate R, I become removed from the population or I've been recovered. And so there's a gain in the density of recovered people because of infected people becoming recovered. And then finally, there is plus KSI. So these are the equations of the SIR model. And now it's a three-dimensional system. But again, notice that when I add them up, S plus I plus R dot is equal to 0, which says that S plus I plus R is equal to 1. So in fact, there's only two independent variables. Now, if you want to try and represent what's going on in the density space, so here, for example, is S, I, R. I'm constrained to be on the plane S plus I plus R equals 1. And so that's this little triangle like this. And so we're going to focus attention on what happens inside of this triangle. And so let me now plot the triangle like this. And so let's put S over here and I over here. Because these are, you know, the dynamics of R is pretty simple. R just increases with time. So notice, in particular, that R dot is always positive, and S dot is always negative. So all the action happens here. We have a negative term, and we have a positive term. Which one wins out determines whether we're going to have an epidemic or not. If I dot is always negative, then that means that the infection goes away and not much interesting is happening. On the other hand, if I dot is positive, that means that the density of infected people is growing, and that might correspond to an epidemic. So all of the action is contained in this middle equation, and that's where we want to focus our attention on. And so I'm just going to say one more line about this about the system. So in order to analyze what's going on, it turns out it's very helpful. See, the thing is that the dependence on time, you see in all these dynamical systems that the time dependence, we never really looked at it explicitly. We looked at how things evolved in the density space. So similarly here, in order to focus attention on the interesting behavior, let's look at, take equation 2 and divide it by equation 1. And we'll get rid of the time and look at how the density of infecteds depends on the density of susceptibles. So I look at di over ds. So when I divide through, I'm going to get minus ri plus ksi. And downstairs, I have minus ksi. And so I can write this as minus 1 plus r over k times s. This is a very important equation because it allows us to now resolve the behavior of the process. So notice that if s, and let me define this just to make my life simple. Let's write this minus 1 plus r bar over s. I guess that's what I have in my notes. So I'm defining r bar is equal to r divided by k. So the point here is that if s is greater than r bar, then this thing is less than 1, but we're subtracting minus 1. That means that di by ds is less than 0. And what does that mean? That means you start with some population, which is initially everybody susceptible. And as the susceptibles are decreasing, as ds is negative, in order for this thing to be less than 0, that means that di is positive. So this means that we have an epidemic. Whereas if s is less than r bar, then di by ds is greater than 0, and we have no epidemic. Because as s is decreasing, I is also decreasing. And so that just means you start with some population of people who are susceptible, some population of people who are sick, and they both decrease with time. And so here is the basic qualitative behavior of this classic SIR model. So this brings me to the end of my story about homogeneous population biology reactions. And notice here that in all of this discussion, I've made some very important and drastic assumptions. OK, question.
If S is always decreasing, then won't at some point a non-epidemic change to an epidemic using that argument?
No, because all that's going to happen is the density of susceptibles will go to 0, the density of infectors will go to zero, and everybody's recovered.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I said this incorrectly. The density of susceptibles, no, the thing is that the density of infectors will eventually, when there's nobody infected, if I is equal to zero, then notice that nothing happens anymore. S, I, and R dot are all zero. So once the density of the density of infectors is decreasing with time, and eventually when it hits zero, then the whole system stops. You end up with the population frozen in whatever state you had. Some people will still be susceptible, but there's no infection around to infect them, and some people will have been recovered.
So that's really then the initial value of S?
That's right. The initial value of S determines everything. Yes, sir.
Yeah, this might be the same question. I'm not sure. But why is DIDS less than zero an epidemic and the other one is no epidemic?
Because the thing is that if I go back to this equation, we see that S dot is always negative. So the density of susceptibles is always decreasing. So since it's always decreasing, if this is less than zero, then this is going to increase, which means that the density of infected is increasing with time. So anyways, just coming back to my sort of sermon at the end here is that I'm assuming that my population is uniformly spread out throughout the system. There's no space in any of this. So the only variable was the density. And moreover, the density was assumed to be continuous everywhere so that I could write down continuum equations for the evolution of the density. What I'm going to do for the first half of tomorrow's lecture is I'm going to study processes where I'm thinking about small numbers of reactants, where the average density is not a full characterization of the system. So for example, if I think about the simplest problem, I mean, let me just write down maybe one more equation. So now let's talk about discrete reactions. So instead of having a density rho, the basic parameter system will be P sub n, the probability that there are n reactants in the system. And if there was no fluctuations, then the mean value of n, which might be the density, would be the natural variable in the problem. But if you have discrete systems, then different realizations of a discrete system may have different evolutions. And so it's the full probability density of the number of particles that's the basic variable in the system. And so I'm going to just write down one more equation, and then I'm going to stop. I want to write it down just so you can think about it, which is the problem of just single particle birth. So let's imagine, again, that we have individuals that give birth asexually, and everybody gives birth at exactly the same rate, and there's nothing else in the system. So we saw that in the continuum limit, the equation was rho dot was equal to rho, no self-regulation. But now, what is the appropriate equation for Pn dot? How does this evolve with time? And so the point here is that with the rates n minus 1, because every single individual in the population gives birth at the same rate, so times Pn times the probability of having n minus 1 particle in the system times an intrinsic birth rate that it can set equal to 1, you will increase the probability of having n particles in the system. And then you have minus n pn. This is the so-called master equation for the probability density of having n particles in the system. Notice some very nice features of this equation. First of all, if there wasn't this, does anybody recognize this equation? Pn dot is pn minus 1 minus pn? Not quite Fibonacci, because it's with a minus sign.
Yes.
It's the equation of the Poisson process. And so for those of you who know what the Poisson distribution is, the solution of the Poisson process is precisely the Poisson distribution. And I invite you to solve the set of equations without the n's here. And you'll get, when you solve it, you'll get the Poisson distribution as the result. But with the n's here, this should be screaming at you how to solve it. How should I solve the system of equations?
What? Generating functions.
Generating functions, exactly so. What I'm going to show tomorrow is how to apply the generating function to solve this in a very elegant and very appealing way. And this is a nice example where one can carry through all the analysis from soup to nuts in a very elementary way, and it has a very nice solution. And we're going to see something really amazing, which is that in a single particle birth, the most likely event is that there's only one particle in the system. even though the system is giving birth, and the more you have particles, the more they're giving birth. But the most likely event, if you start with one particle, is that there's one particle in the system. So that'll be for tomorrow.
Okay, just let me make the following announcement. So, this afternoon we're going to have the naval training course.
Yeah.
So, everyone should be here at 3:30 with your computers, laptops, and the naval installed. If you have problems with the installation of naval, go and talk to Joy Montgomery around 1 o'clock now. But only if you have problems. The most important thing is that you should have your naval already installed, and all of you should have your laptops. Okay, then there will be one more class forward for this course, consisting of 3 programs, and it will be due Monday.
Yeah!
All problems are guaranteed to be impossible.
Really?
No.